This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And we're coming to you this segment from the Mountain Cloud Zen Center, where we are with Henry Shookman, who is the spiritual director here. He's an associate Zen master, and retired Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who is a member of this center and on the board. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Nice to be with you, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you both back on the program and in a different context and on a different topic. We've had you on before, Henry, talking about fiction that you've written. We've had you on, Joe Wilson, talking about politics and various manifestations. And here we are at the Mountain Cloud Zen Center talking about Zen. The occasion of our conversation is a book called Zen, The Authentic Gate by Kuan Yamada. I don't know if I said that right.
Pretty good.
What is this book all about, Henry?
Well, Kuan Yamada Roshi was a great Zen master in the mid to late 20th century. And in the course of his teaching, he wrote a very clear and kind of thorough introduction to Zen, a sort of map of the whole Zen path, if you will, which only appeared in Japanese. And actually, an English translation was made slowly over the years. And a year or two ago, it sort of fell into the hands of myself and one of my teachers, Joan Rick Roshi. And together we edited it. And it was published recently by Wisdom. So it is basically an introductory volume on Zen.
Of which there are several in English, but really not that many? Or
there actually aren't many. There are many books on Zen, but as for a kind of clear overall introductory map of Zen, there's not a lot.
How did you come to Zen, Henry?
Well, let's see. Initially, I took up meditation in my mid-20s because I was miserable. And a friend of mine was doing transcendental meditation, and I saw how much it had helped him, and I thought maybe it would help me. And the organization, it was quite expensive to learn, actually, but I was a graduate student at the time, and they were doing a great deal for graduates, for graduate students. So I signed up. I did my week of training every evening. And promptly slept for a week solidly. I was so ragged and exhausted and anxious that I was carrying an enormous fatigue and didn't realize it. But once I meditated, it became clear how exhausted I was.
So you'd sort of been holding all of that exhaustion inside, and the meditation kind of let it out and you had to rest.
Exactly. There was enough relaxation, just enough to let that go. But anyway, after a few years of that, I stumbled across some writing of Zen master Dogen, who's a famous 13th century Japanese master. And I didn't understand a word of it, but I kind of couldn't forget it. And the reason I couldn't forget it is that it reminded me somehow of a strange event that had befallen me when I was 19 years old, when one day I suddenly had a kind of, I guess what would be called an epiphany, that, you know, hit me with sort of tremendous force, a wonderful sense of resolution of everything, basically. And I'd always wanted to kind of know what on earth that had been, because there was nothing in my worldview or my education that fitted with it.
What happened at the time when this epiphany took place?
I was stone cold sober. I was staring at sunlight on the sea, and suddenly what I was seeing was simply not outside me. It's very hard to put it into words. As they always say, this kind of thing is, what's the word? Sapathis understanding or whatever.
Yeah.
So you can't really, but it was as if everything I'd ever known wasn't out there. It was all somehow one single reality that included me, as if there was no It was like one single dream, one single body, one single mind. There are no very good ways of putting this. There are only some labels that traditions like Zen have come up with. But but the point was really that it seemed important. You know, it was sort of, it kind of overshadowed everything else in a sense.
Now it lasted for a moment
with a glorious afterglow. It was like a sudden seeing through, you know, and then this glorious afterglow that went on for weeks and then abruptly stopped when I went home. I'd been away. And anyway, so it took me a long time to pick out the pieces, really. And when I heard read this bit of Dogen, Master Dogen, although it made no sense, I felt I knew that he could only have been talking about what happened at that moment, a decade earlier, because nothing else would make sense of his strange language, but that would. And so I got into Zen. I changed horses from transcendental meditation to Zen meditation.
Now, for those who don't meditate, it seems that there's all kinds of meditation traditions, and what's really the difference? You sit still in a often not very comfortable position after a while in silence and things happen. What's the difference between one and another? What is special about Zen meditation in particular?
Well, I don't know if it's so special. It just has its own way of doing it, which is very bare bones. There's basically no doctrine. There's nothing really to believe. It's just a practice that we do. And somehow, I guess, in the DNA of the Zen tradition, it carries an understanding of things, you know, that's radically different from our ordinary understanding, although it supports us in our ordinary life. Some traditions are more, I guess you might say, more internal. You know, they're really about sitting quietly alone for long stretches. You get instructions and you go and implement them alone and internally. Zen put some importance on sangha, community, and on the relationship between a teacher and a student, which is thought to be the kind of lifeblood of the tradition, and above all, living it out in daily life, ordinary life. The Zen doesn't really appreciate people being unordinary. The whole sort of hope and thrust of it is to end up very ordinary, you know, looking absolutely indistinguishable from anybody else in the crowd.
Now, did you find a teacher? Has that been part of your own path?
Yeah, it was a very important part of my path. When I eventually found a teacher, it took me ages. I went to lots of centers and did lots of retreats and never felt I could quite trust them for one reason or another. And eventually I found two teachers, one after the other. Both are still teachers of mine, and they're both in the same lineage. One is a very sort of ordinary retired lawyer. The other is a wonderful former Catholic nun who became a Zen master. And they very unobtrusive people. The whole point is really supposed to be diminishing the ego and pride and seeking name and gain have no place in that. And I somehow felt that many of the kind of bigger name teachers I'd run across on my search for a teacher seemed you know, famous and or well known in the world of meditation, and with prosperous communities. And well, that's not really what this is about. They didn't seem to me, in some sense, that different from many of the big name writers that I'd occasionally rubbed shoulders with as a writer myself, who, you know, also could be rather full of themselves. And I'm sorry, I shouldn't really be.
Well, there is
people
that.
Off like this,
no, I've noticed that myself. There is a kind of like spiritual celebrity archetype. You know, you meet them around here, you meet them all over the place, and I think it's one of the pitfalls of, and maybe one of the challenges of becoming a teacher.
In this lineage, if you want to be a teacher, you can't be one. I didn't want to be. My teachers asked me. In the end, three of them said they really wanted me to do it, including the abbot, the current abbot. And You know, to be honest, I sort of had no idea what I'd do. So I when I began, I just started doing what my teachers had done as best I could, you know, less well than they did it, but trying to.
So you just sort of organically started doing it and one thing led to another, as opposed to setting out with your goal to be a great Zen master teacher.
Oh my God, no goal like that. All I wanted and still want was to be a little less troubled, you know, as a troubled guy. And the meditation, to my utter astonishment, eventually radically changed that. Radically. And my wife likes me much more, you know, kids like me more. It's been better all around. And sometime after that kind of change, you know, the time came when they said, Henry, you've done all the training that we expect you to do. You'll have ongoing training, but we want you to start leading people in this way. And I kind of, I suppose, reluctantly felt I had to obey. Obedience was something that was all very new to me. I'd been a very rebellious kind of guy. And
but when the Zen teacher says, you're next, you say, okay.
I say, well, you know, you got to be kidding. Actually, basically, you got to be kidding me. And then I said again, say, oh, you're not still on about that. And eventually they said, well, okay, tell me what to do.
We're talking to Henry Shookman. Now, Joe Wilson, how did you come to this practice?
Well, I came much more recently than Henry. We've been here for several years. And I started going to see the Tibetan monks when they were doing the mandalas down in Santa Fe at the Surat facility. And we got to do some sort of chanting meditations with them and spent quite a bit of time with them. And it was very relaxing, very peaceful. And interesting. It seemed to me to be an interesting way to kind of look at a part of the world that I'd never been to before, look at it through the migration of a religion or a spiritual practice through from one culture to another. And so I took a course in Buddhism, and you know, eventually you end up in Japan and Zen. And when I got there, I kind of washed up on the shores here of Mountain Cloud.
You went to actual the country Japan?
No. I took the course, but as you watch the movement of Buddhism from northern India through Tibet and China and then ultimately into Japan, you end up with the tradition of Zen Buddhism, and that brought me here. And as Henry said earlier, it is a practice. It is without trappings. It is without a lot of formality, and it is relaxing, and it does make you less reactive. I find that I can actually read about Dick Cheney now without having a visceral reaction, and that's a good thing, given my past with the Bush administration. And as Henry said, I think I can. My kids can tolerate me better. My wife tolerates me better. So it's been. It's been a fun experience, both in terms of seeing how the tradition evolved from 2,600 years ago and how it migrated to Japan. And it's been a most interesting practice just in the extent to which it does yield all those kind of visceral and physical responses of non-reactivity, and also has a nice, interesting spiritual and learning component to it.
Given your history, I mean, you were working in really intense kind of work that most of us couldn't have ever done in the first place. I mean, it takes a certain amount, I would think, of non-reactivity to go into diplomacy. Otherwise, any little crazy thing that somebody else does would set you off and have pretty big implications because the stakes are so high when you're working in nuclear materials or when you're working in relationships between countries. If you had had, for example, this practice before you even started that, do you think it would have affected the way you worked? Do you think you would have continued to choose the profession that you did?
Oh, I don't know. You don't get second chances at that, so I couldn't tell you. What I can tell you, though, is that involved in the practice now, it does give me an additional perspective, both on my day-to-day life and also in thinking about those things that I've been involved with in the past. I just came here, for example, from giving a speech on Middle East politics and the refugee crisis. And I find that that having some peace of mind and some ability to put everything in its proper place has made it I think easier for me to understand what I went through in the past and to explain some of the situations that we now find ourselves in and why in a more dispassionate and manner than I might otherwise have done.
Tell us more about that. How does this practice that you're doing help you understand some of these situations that we're in politically?
Well, I would just go back to the Iraq War and my fight with the Bush administration, which, of course, was very visceral, and it was very emotionally heavily laden. The idea of the Bush administration was to deflect attention from their lies by destroying my character and the character of my wife, Valerie. So it became very much of a personal feud, basically. And so for many, many years, it became very difficult to read, and people still write about it as they try and get pardons for convicted felons in this matter. So just having the practice and having now engaged in it for a little bit over a year and a half now, it's given me the opportunity to sort of step away from it. And to look at it as if it is not part of me, but it is an object somewhere in the distance, and look at it from all different angles, and understand that it is really all about them and not about me, and not to worry about it so much, and understand it, and be able, I think, to explain more the consequences of what they did, less in terms of what they were trying to do to me, and more in terms of what they did to the country.
Henry Shookman, you are nodding when he's talking, and what he's saying makes me think about the whole issue of cause and effect, and that everything has a precedent. Every single person is even born with a precedent, according to this way of thinking. And every situation, political or otherwise, that we find ourselves in has not only a cause, but a chain of causes that goes way back.
Yeah, nothing is independent. Everything is codependently arising, as Buddha said. So in other words, nothing, if you track any single thing down, you find that it doesn't exist in any way independently, only dependently, contingently. But actually, when Joe was talking, I was really sort of admiring this, that basically the sense of perspective, the variability and flexibility of perspective, which is one thing that can come from this practice. In fact, I mean, I would say, maybe this is a little bit superlative, but you can kind of get a very fundamental sense of perspective in a way through this practice, that where, you know, I think the Dalai Lama being able to feel gratitude towards the Chinese persecutors of his country or something like that, you know, how could that be without really having let go of so much that we would normally want to cling to as a vantage point, as a place of perspective on things, and to let that go and to either have no particular fixed center or to have a very kind of universal sense of perspective? That's an amazing gift for any of us to receive.
What is the Dalai Lama grateful for?
Oh man, I'm not sure if I can remember now. But he said like they've given him an opportunity to work on his capacity for forgiveness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I come back to over and over and over again over all the years that I've been looking at and to some extent practicing Buddhist meditation and things like that, is that, I mean, if you've got a bunch of mafiosos or a bunch of Dick Cheneys and George Bushes or whoever it is that's really doing a lot of harm, by forgiving them, you kind of play right into their hands and let them do more evil stuff.
Well, there are teachings on forgiveness, you know, where that forgiving doesn't necessarily mean forgetting, you know, and forgiving doesn't necessarily mean that you don't do something to try to staunch the damage.
Let me add, I'm certainly not in a position yet, as the Dalai Lama is, of being able to forgive or forget George Bush or what the Bush administration did to the country and to the world.
And to you.
And to us as a family. Although I'm more at peace with that, because at the end of the day, they lost, we won. I think everybody knows the disaster that they perpetrated and the way that they tried to hide it by destroying us. The greater focus is really less on forgiving them and more on striving for more social justice, a different equilibrium in the way that we look at these issues. And in fact, it was in dealing with the refugee crisis, one of the things that comes to mind that's consistent with this practice is that you can't, if you want to address the issue of migration, mass migrations, you have to do it in the context that we're all one, that they are not the other. Right now, we're in a stage in our political life where one of our candidates, at least, and a couple of them, are talking about them as the other. And until we start recognizing that we're all part of the same entity, the human species, we're not going to be able to get our arms around that. And so I think that... The fact that it is a very it's a very sort of peaceful practice. It's not necessarily passive. That there is much room there for taking on the issues that afflict the species, the human race.
Can I just add something else, which is that, you know, I don't, much as I'm huge, infinitely grateful to Zen practice, I don't necessarily know that it has all the answers about how we should behave. I mean, one of the teachers in the same lineage, David Loy, great writer on Buddhism, his latest book is saying that actually the Asian wisdom traditions aren't particularly good on social justice. And the West's tradition of social reform has at least been trying to address it for hundreds of years. And we're kind of, you know, we've got somewhere. We don't have public hangings anymore. And, you know, we don't have slavery anymore. So we've made social reform and social justice a higher priority in the West. Well, at least we have done. I'm not quite sure currently
where we are now.
Where we are now, but we have done that. I mean, David Loy's argument is that actually the Eastern traditions may need a bit of the Western traditions and vice versa.
Now, one of the things that interests me, Henry, is that you're a fiction writer and you're a good fiction writer. And I heard a speaker recently talking, who's a fiction writer, wonderful, gentle soul, beautiful writer, talking about the process of writing fiction and said something along, I'm not going to quote it exactly right, but something about when you're writing fiction, you create these characters whom you love and then you torture them. And that is the nature of fiction. And then drama unfolds and conflict and resolution of conflict and more conflict. And I was wondering, like, what that process was like for you and how it had changed, or if it had changed, since you started this practice, which is in many ways about bringing inner peace to yourself and seems to have done that for you.
Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, initially, when I first took up meditation, basically, I was hoping to become a better writer. And there were various fiction writers and prose writers I admired very much, and some poets, who practiced Zen. Zen has a long, long tradition, especially with poetry. I mean, 1,500 years of Zen poetry, you know. And it helped. It helped because, you know, a slightly clearer mind, able to work more efficiently, more deeply, more getting absorbed more quickly into the narrative and that kind of thing. I wrote more, and I think I wrote better than I previously had done. And that was great. I published, I think, 3 novels so far. But the further I got in Zen, the more I found my commitment to that kind of writing. And in fact, at the same time, I was getting busier as a teacher of writing, you know. And my commitment to that kind of writing just became less fierce than it had been. And my ambitions as a writer got more and more undermined and weaker, and without the kind of, you know, sort of little, at least a few, a bit of salt of desperation in the whole business of living, my writing became less important to me. It had been driven by various things, including, you know, I don't know, inner pressure or something. And at a certain point, Zen practice through the training under my teachers, it dissipated. And then, oh, what am I going to do now? You know, and I stopped writing really in that kind of way. I don't really do it anymore.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel great. I feel I ought to say I miss it, but I don't. Yeah. I still write poems. I published another book of poems fairly recently. That's slightly different.
It is different because it's not a narrative.
Exactly.
You're not setting people up for conflict.
That's right. And also, it's not so long term.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a snapshot.
Very interesting. I mean, I like to sometimes read interviews with writers and performers and comedians, and as comedians especially, they say, I mean, comedians are some of the unhappiest people ever, and their comedy comes from that unhappiness. And another person said, if you want to be a writer, here's how you start. Have an unhappy childhood. You'd go from there. And it makes you wonder, because, I mean, there's so much service that good fiction and good narrative brings to us. And it's at the cost, is it at the cost of that person's happiness?
Well, T.S. Eliot thought so. So the more perfect the writer, the more miserable they are, the more the suffering. I certainly have friends who are spectacularly good poets who have been profoundly unhappy much of their lives.
Yeah.
And the poems offer these little perfect sort of, like a northern summer, very, very brief, but gloriously beautiful. You know, somehow the pressure of suffering is the kind of forge in which the great poems are made. I don't know, really. I mean, Tolstoy suffered a whole lot, didn't he? There are writers who didn't seem to suffer so much, and I don't think they're necessarily the worse for it. You know, I think there are great writers. I don't know about George Eliot. I don't think she had such an unhappy life, as far as I can remember. I can't really remember now. Jane Austen, did she have such an unhappy life? I don't think so. Virginia Woolf obviously did.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it takes all sorts. You know?
Yeah, so, but somewhere, and probably in all of them, there's a spark of conflict that leads them to go through really the suffering that writing is, because that's not easy either. I heard a writer say, here's how you be a writer, sit in front of a page until you sweat blood.
I know. Well, it can also be very rewarding.
Yeah.
Deeply rewarding.
So we are theoretically talking about Zen. And one of the things, I was up here the other day talking to you, Henry, and you said something which I found intriguing, was that the practice of Zen was a practice that led to being yourself or becoming who you really are. And I wondered if each of you could comment on that and how you even understand the who you really are, like whether that's an essential thing, whether that's something that changes over time or is really contextual.
Well, that's certainly an interesting question, because certainly most of my adult life I've had to play a role, whether it's a role as a diplomat or it's a role as a dissident or political actor or whatever. And certainly this is a place I can come to, something of a refuge where all I really have to do is sit and face the wall. And I get enormous satisfaction out of that. And so the extent to which I no longer am in a position where I have to play a role, need to, or even want to, this is a perfect place to come and adjust to being myself, whatever myself is, but certainly just anonymous Joe Wilson.
Yeah, the question of identity is in the Zen tradition somewhere. There's a famous early master called Bodhidharma who was once asked by an emperor when he was having an interview with the emperor. The emperor asked him, "Who are you standing before me?" And he said, "I don't know." And that "I don't know," that answer sort of echoed down through Zen for 1500 years. And I would say that who we really are, I don't know. I don't know. But it seems this practice takes away notions of who we think we are.
That it matters.
More that it matters, yeah.
Yeah.
It can open us up in ways that we couldn't imagine to sort of, some kind of vast, featureless, marvelous reality that is here right now, but it's not what we normally experience, another sort of dimension to things, sometimes referred to as ku in Japanese, which means sky, so empty firmament. There is a dimension to our experience that is like that, that's just empty. Not empty in some sense of lacking, but just empty. You wouldn't say the sky is lacking, there's a Taoist view that out of that nothing, everything comes. So it's intensely fertile. And Zen has certainly absorbed that some amount of that sort of Taoist view and blended it with its Buddhist view of shunyata, as the Buddhist word meaning something like emptiness. And we can taste that through this practice, and it certainly undermines rather radically our ordinary notions of who we are.
It's funny, I was thinking about this, and when I first came to, I, like you, did a little bit of that transcendental meditation, and then later came across another kind of Vipassana Buddhist practice. But I remember being in my early 20s and not knowing what on earth I was going to do with my life, and that very deep sense of dislocation that you have if you don't, if you're not on a professional track at that age, but you have a lot of energy and you have a lot of mental energy and you don't know where it's going at that moment. And then there was this Buddhist path that was the sense of emptiness and everything and nothing. And I had a kind of cynical moment where I thought, well, these Buddhist monks, they have an identity. They're Buddhist monks. They wear their robes and they go sit on their little cushions and they have their little place and they have their little jobs and they have a very strong identity, much more than I, the sort of college graduate with absolutely no sense of where to go and what to do. And I think that there's a sense of dislocation that so many people experience and that is perhaps going to become the norm in the world that we're moving into now.
Well, it's not just when you're coming out of college. There's also, when you get a little bit older, there's also transitioning from life in Washington, D.C. to life in Santa Fe.
For example.
For example, as an example. Would say at this latter stage, it's not so much that that this is a new identity as much as it is an opening and an opportunity really not to have an identity, not to have to be on guard all the time, just to be able to be open to everything that's flowing around me in ways that when you spend most of your life in a defensive crouch fighting the enemies on all sides, you can't really experience.
Yeah. And also I might just add that actually it's one thing that I particularly appreciate about this lineage and this place, Mountain Cloud, is that there are forms of Zen that are pretty heavy on ritual and form and robes and stuff like that. We don't really do that here. This lineage is actually directly Japanese. And because of that, they don't feel that we ought to be kind of mimicking Japanese styles.
Yeah, because, I mean, what is ordinary for us is wearing what we wear. What is ordinary for them is probably the robes and the bulls, but for us, those things are exotic.
Exactly. So, like, we don't really need chopsticks.
Right. You know,
they just eat with them anyway.
Right.
What's that Woody Allen line? You got to hand it to the Chinese. They're still using chopsticks, and they've seen the fork.
He's also, I think, the author of the statement, "I am two with nature." Which I think speaks to this whole question of what you experienced when you had that first epiphany, Henry, when you were a young man and had a kind of sense of oneness with everything around you. And I think on some level, that is a consciousness not only about other human beings, but of all nature. I mean, when you talk about emptiness and everything coming from nothing, I can't help but think of the Big Bang, where you had a whole bunch of nothing and something maybe the size of a seed that exploded, and in the first gazillionth of a second made all the beginnings of what ended up being the whole periodic table and the basis of life itself.
Yeah, this is maybe sounds like an absolutely crazy thing to say, but I feel that not only, obviously it's still going on, right? The Big Bang is still going on, and somehow I wonder whether the state immediately prior to the Big Bang is still here too, and that's somehow what we can drop into in moments of sudden revelatory experience through Zen practice. I don't know.
I don't know either. And one of the things that I wonder about is, I mean, there are people who have the experience with oneness, and whether that oneness is biological life, because that is really fundamentally who we are and where all of our emotions come from and all of that, or whether it goes back even before to a greater consciousness that precedes biological life, which is this kind of silly esoteric question that we can talk about all day and not come to any conclusions about, but I do think about it sometimes.
It seems like it. It seems like it.
Like what?
Like it goes back to something pre-biological, like that it doesn't exclude the table and the floor and the sky and the...
Your sense of connection to all things.
Yeah.
We're talking to Henry Shookman and Joe Wilson, and the Mountain Cloud Zen Center is where we're broadcasting from. Tell us, Henry, a little bit about, or both of you, this Zen Center that we're sitting in and its history.
It was built in the mid-80s by a group of students and a teacher called Philip Kaplow, who moved here from Rochester, New York. Kaplow actually trained in the same lineage, you know, as it happens, that I'm part of, in Kamakura, Japan. And he helped to edit what became rather a famous book called The Three Pillars of Zen. And at a certain point decided he to move out here and found a center here. It met with quite a bit of resistance and then eventually was created. And shortly thereafter, alas, he had to move back east for various pressing reasons, and so the center has been a little bit for about a quarter of a century it was rather underknown. Is that the right expression? It wasn't very well known, and it was underused, and it had occasional visiting teachers who came, and it would rent it out to other groups and that sort of thing. And then I was invited by the small contingent of the original students of Philip Kaplow just over 5 years ago, to come and start teaching here. And it's a happy thing in a way that it's sort of reconnected with its original founding lineage. The abbot is, maybe Joe could speak a little bit about that, but the abbot's coming, the Japanese abbot, and he was great friends with Kaplow.
Apparently. Henry knows him better than I do, but apparently he was a student with Kaplow in Japan, and he is now the head of the lineage, and he's going to be here for the Sesshin, the retreat of the North American Sanbo Zen collective, Sangha, which will take place the first part of, end of April, first part of May. And he's also going to be rededicating the Zendo on the 5th of May up here at Mountain Cloud. So there'll be a ceremony to rededicate it, and sort of re-inspire the new community, which has grown really exponentially just since I've been here in the last year and a half. I think when I used to come here, we started, there were maybe 10 or 15 people on a Sunday and a few more on a Thursday night. Now it's, you've got to get here early to reserve a place. Actually, there's always room, but it's a much much larger sangha now. So we're looking forward to that. There are a lot of practitioners, a lot of people who are interested in the practice, and our hope is that they will be inspired and interested to come back and resume the practice under Henry's spiritual teaching leadership.
What actually is the practice? What do you do?
You sit still and don't say anything and follow your breath, usually when you start doing it. Just experience the breath and sit silent and still. And we do it in 25-minute increments with 5 minutes of walking in between, which is short by comparison with many other forms of meditation. And we think it's kinder on the legs and the body generally. So, you know, on various times per week, people gather to do that here. Some people do it at home. Many people do it at home primarily for whatever amount of time they choose and come when they can to do it communally here. It's a funny thing, really, to come and gather in order to not talk to one another. It's a really nice thing. You find that, I think I was really slow on this, but starting to pick up on just how immensely valuable it is to sit with other people in silence. It boosts our daily meditation. It changes everything, actually, because we start to realize that this connectedness that's always here, you know, we can find it in a sort of immediate way with other people who are doing the same practice in the room with us, that, wow, you know, we really start to get, somehow I feel it's almost like we get trained or quite spontaneously in just feeling out the presence of others at a sort of deeper level than we're habituated to through our normal forms of communication. So dropping ordinary communication is immensely valuable at teaching us to interact, I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but somehow commune or something with others in a deeper way. It's a beautiful thing.
Does it change the way you interact with them then when you're done and you might sort of chat or have dinner or drink tea or whatever you do after the session is over?
You still do that, right? We still chat.
Sure. There's opportunities afterwards. But, I think it does change your interaction because you are, again, you've spent some time in a position where you're really focusing on your breath, which is not as easy as it sounds.
Oh, it doesn't sound easy.
There are many times when Valerie and I would spend most of our time meditating, but really counting, looking at our shopping lists or our list of things to do or thinking about that. And just the ability to put that aside and then afterwards sit with people who've also tried to do the same thing gives you a sense of what it's like to actually engage in a practice of just sitting.
I have to say that for myself, and I haven't done this particular type of meditation, but what I hit up against most is boredom.
That's one thing that can come up. There's all kinds of stuff that will come up. And that's one of its values, is that we're put in a situation where we're not going to instantly react to what we don't like. And, of course, we may well react, but we've got to sit with it. And I used to go to this monastery where you couldn't blow your nose. And they had a cat, and I'm allergic to cats. And so every time I went there for a treat, the first thing I'd have, I'm so happy to get there, and I'd forgotten, and sit down in my spot in the Zendo, and great, marvelous stillness. And then, oh, no. I need to sneeze. And I'd sneeze, and you were not allowed to, you know, grab your hanky. You
know, why not?
Because you can't move. So you have to sit there. And I remember the first time I did, the monitor was sort of looking down the rows of cushions and shouted, "Let it run!" and literally, and this became familiar to me, having a strand of phlegm dangle from my nose until it reached my hands in my lap.
this practice doesn't require that. This Zendo does not require that.
But I mean, the point I want to make is that actually to not instantly wipe the nose, you know, I learned something from it.
I
grew up with eczema, and itching was just sort of torment for me, and I probably would, because of the history of that, would sort of overreact every time there was an itch. Oh no, maybe it's coming back. But to sit and not scratch, it's just an itch. To study the experience of an itch and the wishing for an itch to go, learning from not responding the way we normally would, to seeing how powerful these dynamics of aversion and longing and so on really are in us, but to be able to just experience them as phenomena that arise and pass.
Yeah, not scratching the itch is a good one, because it comes up every time you sit. There'll be something will itch and eye tick or something, and suddenly you're focusing on it, and then it's gone.
Right. So not scratching an itch when you're sitting, that somehow translates out into the wide world and helps you be, the word you used, Joe, was non-reactive in the rest of your life, even when you're not sitting.
Yeah, I use the horn a lot less when people cut me off in traffic. You have the luxury of that extra bit of time and sensibility before you react to the various environmental things that are going on around you and perhaps impacting on you.
Yeah. I think gradually also you're sort of wearing down the, you know, deep attachment to me getting my way. It is gently over time, well, sometimes not so gently, wearing that down. Because this practice isn't, some people think, you know, that isn't it sort of self-obsessed and selfish? And actually it's not at all. And it really, if it ever is, it's wrong, you know, because it's supposed to be about letting go of self and acting. And, you know, that is what leads to discovering this sort of oneness with all beings and maybe beyond biological beings. But that, you know, really must lead us to behaving differently, or it's not really that useful.
I think it's also helpful to be in, as we are sitting here right now with our headphones and everything, a very peaceful space on a very peaceful hill in a building that feels very handmade. And that kind of environment fosters, I think, your being able to practice in this way.
Sure, absolutely. And the people who come here self-select, they come here because they want to learn or to appreciate the benefits of meditation. And so, sure, there is, it's conducive to the practice. And I will just say one of the benefits of it for me is that I'm not always the central, the main actor in my own play, in my own head, which is sometimes difficult in a day-to-day life when you're called hither and yon to do various things and play different roles.
Yeah, at the same time, I mean, we have a very active project teaching meditation in prisons. And, of course, the people who do that, they get the recharge here.
Yeah.
And then go over there. There's some tremendous things happening among meditators in prison. It can be incredibly helpful.
There's also on Wednesday nights here, there is an introductory course on just basic meditation, so that it's an introduction to the practice, some short meditation, some understanding of the techniques of how one does it, and an opportunity really to come at it gradually, so that it's not total immersion. You don't have to go on a 30-day retreat your first week out.
Right. And those are Wednesday evenings at five o'clock.
5 o'clock, yeah. And it's the idea is really to help, through coming to that event, people learning to develop their own daily practice.
Henry Shookman is spiritual director of Mountain Cloud Zen Center. Retired Ambassador Joe Wilson is a member and a board member here. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.